You are about to hear a presentation by Peter Lumsdain, who is affiliated with Physicians for Social Responsibility in Washington State, talking about turning the clock back from midnight, how we can address the crisis of 2018 and renew eco-justice peace work for the 21st century. He is on a nationwide speaking tour that included an event in North Carolina. We begin with him describing that event.
It was a PSR, Western North Carolina chapter, that sponsored it, but we also had folks from Veterans for Peace there. We had a woman, Mary Olson, who is the Southeast Director of the Nuclear Information and Resource Service, NIRS. Some of you may know of that. This era from the 1980s to now is bracketed by two really significant Nobel Prizes, right? So the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War got the Nobel Peace Prize, you know, back in the 1980s, and then ICANN, right? Another nuclear disarmament organization, out of the blue, you know, many people had never heard of ICANN, got the Nobel Peace Prize just this past year. You all know that nuclear weapons, nuclear war, nuclear disarmament is coming back somewhat into people's attention because of the whole Korea thing, but not just that, right? So there was a photograph, a nuclear explosion mushroom cloud on the cover of Time magazine a few months ago for the first time in many years. We know that the experts in the field have said that the tensions, this is pre-Korea crisis, right? The tensions between the United States and Russia are at an almost all-time high, probably as high or some experts think higher than they were during the Cold War. There's a whole new generation, as you know, of nuclear weapon systems that are being developed. We live about 35 minutes from the Bangor submarine base on Puget Sound, you know, the western base of the Trident doomsday machine. When I was in Raleigh, North Carolina, I just met with my old friend Patrick O'Neill, who is part of the Kings Bay Plowshares group with Elizabeth McAllister and the others. He's out on electronic surveillance bail for the moment before they send with the thing on his ankle. And with his college-age daughter, Anne, who just graduated from high school. And it was really interesting to get her perspective, as well as Patrick's, on this whole situation, what people her age, you know, are thinking and talking about. And again, I think it's not, I mean, she grew up in a very unusual Catholic worker, nuclear resistance family, but still, you know, I think it is not an easy message or pitch or sell to people who are like college age right now, young workers, college students, but it can be done. Lily out in Seattle is doing this. And I think that the potential is there. And we all know that we need a multi-generational movement. We need a multi-ethnic movement. We need a movement that can, I believe, this is my opinion, not try to cover and integrate with every single possible issue under the sun, but to take certain key areas and draw the lines of connection between them, which I would say, you know, economic justice, environmental justice, including climate, and nuclear war are very key. Daniel Ellsberg, right, who risked 112 years in prison to release the truth to the American people. He's 83 now. He came and spoke in Seattle. That was actually the point of contact when I got involved with PSR, because he has a new book called The Doomsday Machine, which is out. And Ellsberg has laid out very, very clearly. I mean, he has a kind of left perspective, whatever, but he's laid out very clearly that this is a long-term, deeply entrenched, bipartisan, institutional psychosis in the American power structure. So, you know, I don't think, whatever people think of Trump, the problem is much deeper and more structural. I don't know if that speaks to what you're saying, but I think that the more that we can try to, certainly we have to speak our minds and challenge what we believe is right and wrong in the political field, but the more that we can look for common ground around critical human issues, I think that's really important. I heard a presentation last year about the climate crisis, and one thing that this was done by like high level, you know, professionals, people who are really engaged nationally, internationally, and one thing I noticed about it, I mean, it's kind of obvious, but it was very, very evident listening to this, is that they were trying to carefully balance a sense of extreme urgency and dire consequences with a sense of empowerment and hope. We know that there was a massive movement not only in the 1980s, but also in the 50s and early 60s, ban the bomb. You know, some of the folks I've been talking with at Veterans for Peace National Office and I'm going to be trying to do some speaking and work with them as well. You know, do you all know about this boat, the Golden Rule? Has everybody heard about that?
Yeah.
Okay, but most of you haven't. So in the 1950s, at the height of this, there were thousands and thousands of people in Trafalgar Square and mass demonstrations, and Dorothy Day, the founder of the Catholic Worker Movement, and others were refusing to go into the shelters in New York City and so forth and so on, you know, with these air raid drills that they were staging. There was a lot of ferment back then, and in the midst of this, the United States and also Russia were doing on a regular basis the thing which people are so horrified that Kim Jong-un might possibly consider at some point, detonating a hydrogen bomb in the atmosphere over the Pacific. But that was being done all the time by the United States. Bikini Atoll, any we talk. We did some work with folks from Kwajalein at one point who were in a different phase of that militarization, nuclear militarization of the South Pacific. And so some people felt like, you know, somebody needs to intervene, at least in a symbolic way or whatever they can. So there was a boat, and it was called, appropriately enough, the Golden Rule. It's a sailing sloop. It was an ocean-going sailing sloop. And this crew of people said, we're going to sail this into the hydrogen bomb detonation zones when these tests are coming up and put ourselves in front of this. I mean, you know, people in India with Gandhi's movement that he was involved in sat on the railroad tracks, right? The sit-ins at the lunch counters and different things that people have put themselves in front of. Well, we're faced with hydrogen bomb after hydrogen bomb going off in the South Pacific, vaporizing entire islands there and so forth. So we're going to sail into this zone. So they went from California and they got as far as Hawaii, and they were seized by federal military officials in Hawaii. And at that point, this guy Earl Reynolds, who was an anthropologist, he had his own boat. He had gone into Hiroshima to interview people shortly after the bombing. Earl Reynolds had been in Hiroshima, right? And he had a boat too. And it was called the Phoenix, or the Phoenix of Hiroshima. Phoenix, you know, rising from the ashes of the fire, right? And so Earl and Barbara Reynolds decided, okay, well, the Golden Rule got nabbed. We'll come in from a different angle, and we'll go to the test zone. So they sailed their boat, and they made it. They made it right into the hydrogen bomb detonation zone, and they were seized with considerable force, let us say, by the U.S. military and hauled out. But it was a very, very dramatic action. And in fact, through a chain of events, the ship's bell from the Phoenix passed down to me, and I'm probably going to loan it to Veterans for Peace, because they pulled the first boat, the Golden Rule, out of the bottom of a harbor in California several years ago, where it was lying wrecked. It had been sunken in a storm in derelict condition. And they got all these shipwrights. There's a lot of shipwrights where I live in Port Townsend, Washington. It's a big industry building and fixing boats. Anyway, they recruited these shipwrights, and they fixed this thing up, and they rigged it with sails. I've got a picture of it over here. It's got a big peace sign on the sail, nuclear disarmament sign. And now they are sailing it. The Veterans for Peace Nuclear Disarmament Program. I mean, I always respected Veterans for Peace. I knew folks in Veterans for Peace, but I never thought of them as a nuclear disarmament organization, but they have a very strong nuclear disarmament program, and it is centered on this boat, the Golden Rule, with the ban the bomb sign on the sail. They're sailing it up and down the west coast of the United States, and they're going to Hawaii, and they're going to Japan for the 75th anniversary of the Hiroshima bombing. So they asked if they could borrow the ship's bell from the other boat. I said, yeah, I think we could arrange that. And anyway, so Veterans for Peace, I think, is in a time when it's very hard to get traction for nuclear disarmament. I think they are a rising force within the nuclear disarmament realm, and I think that's a good alliance. I'm sure you have Veterans for Peace folks here in Kansas City, maybe even here in this room tonight, but I think their national office, right, is in St. Louis. So anyway, that's a good point. And I think this kind of legacy of actions, with all of that movement, we did achieve an atmospheric test ban treaty in 1963. And it's also true, some people dismiss this. I don't dismiss it. It does not remove the critical nuclear peril over this planet, but the fact that the arsenals have shrunk by at least 75 or 80% over the last couple decades, it is a step forward, okay? It is something that people fought and struggled for in a nonviolent way over years and years and years. So we need to give ourselves credit, I think, for some of the work that has been done. I think that's part of it, a sense of empowerment, just like the climate movement. We're making some progress. People are coming together. We're struggling. Of course, Standing Rock, you know, galvanized the nation. Brendan and Sophia and Meg and I went out to Standing Rock in December for the vets mobilization that year. It was an amazing experience. And the climate movement and the movement to protect the earth from out of control corporate and government resource extraction, you know, which all came together at Standing Rock, and the right of indigenous peoples to control their own lands. All of these things are convergent forces. Yeah, the pipeline went through in North Dakota, it's true, but I think it shows the potential of what people can do and what can be mobilized. So I just think we need to, it's not a question of saying like, well, climate is the big thing and we can't really worry about nuclear weapons. No. We all know that nuclear weapons are a critical threat to humanity and this planet. But I think it is a question of building connections. There's an outfit called the Future of Life Institute, which is organized by physicists in the University of California and MIT, Max Tegmark and those guys. And they work on what's called existential risk. And they've identified three key areas of what they believe is existential risk for the 21st century. Tegmark is a colleague of the late Stephen Hawking. They wrote a very important op-ed together a few years ago. These guys are high-powered, you know, scientists, physicists. So what they've identified is global ecological corrosion, including, not limited to, but including climate chaos.
Climate what?
Climate chaos, climate disruption, whatever you want to call it. Second, nuclear weapons, nuclear war, the nuclear arsenals. And third, the extremely rapid rise of artificial intelligence technology on this planet. And they see those as the three critical existential risks for humanity, and that they're connected with each other.
You are listening to Peter Lumsdaine speaking at an event July 6, organized in part by PeaceWorks Kansas City.
William Joy. Anybody ever heard of William Joy? Okay. So, and before I talk about William Joy, I will also mention that, you know, just as we had nuclear whistleblowers, some of whom took great risks, and some of them who took none, there used to be this thing, I called it the ex-war criminal speaking circuit, you know, where you had all these guys who were right in the middle of the nuclear command system, but they'd retired on very comfortable pensions, and then they went out and gave peace talks. Well, I'm glad they were giving peace talks, but, you know, they're very different than people like Robert C. Aldrich, who threw his whole career in the wastebasket to leave Lockheed and expose the U.S. first strike program. They're very different than Dan Ellsberg, who risked 112 years in prison, you know. And but, you know, we had people from inside speaking out, people who used to work in the Strategic Air Command. Generals will say, you know, the American public will never know how close we came, and not just the Cuban Missile Crisis. So the same thing is true in the computer technology industry, because you have people who are from the top levels of the scientific and academic and technological elite who are starting to speak up. Dr. Sherry Turkle at MIT. She was the director of this society and technology program at MIT for years, early advocate of the internet, but became more and more concerned and in fact alarmed by where this was going. Her latest book, which is several years old, I don't know if any of you have heard of Sherry Turkle, anyway, is called Alone Together, Why We Expect More and More from Technology and Less from One Another. So, you know, Dr. Turkle has really raised this question, the rise of social robotics, robots to teach kids, robots to accompany elderly people, robots to take care of sick people, you know. And then you have, you know, people like Stephen Hawking spoke out very strongly to co-authored this, you know, artificial intelligence could be the hugest breakthrough in human history. Unfortunately, it could also be the last. He wrote that in the London Independent with this guy, Max Tegmark. And then Elon Musk, you know, who's not my guru, but he is a billionaire high-tech industrialist. And Musk told this story. I don't know if you guys heard about this a few years ago. He said, he was talking to some group, and he goes, you know, he's done many talks about artificial intelligence. Even though he's involved in developing, he's also saying, hey, you know, we've got to be aware of the dangers, including the danger of triggering nuclear war. Musk has talked about this. Anyway, he told this story. He said, you know, I'm not a student of mythology. I'm no Joseph Campbell. But if you look at these old stories, he's not a particularly spiritual, religious, whatever. But he said, you know, if you look at these old stories in a lot of cultures about the necromancers and the magicians and the sorcerers and the adepts conjuring up these powers, these beings, these forces, you know, they always think that they're going to conjure them up to be their servants, to work for them, to do their bidding. But then Ma says, but if you read to the end of the stories, it never works out that way. He said, what our society is doing right now with this breakneck development of artificial intelligence is summoning the demon. That's what Musk said. So I made this t-shirt, it's one of a kind, that exactly has that Elon Musk, quote, AI research, summoning the demon, right? So you have these voices from inside, and one of the first voices, one of the most important voices, which most people have forgotten now, was a guy named Bill Joy. Radical, hippie, environmental, no, actually he wasn't. He was a multi-millionaire software developer. Sun Microsystems Corporation in Silicon Valley. His teams invented a lot of the operating systems that we use now on our laptops and desktop computers. So Bill Joy was a world-class software architect, co-founder of Sun Microsystems. And he wrote a article in Wired magazine in April of 2000 called Why the Future Doesn't Need Us. Doesn't need software architects, right? No, doesn't need human beings. And he said, there is a hopeful side to this, I'm gonna tell you what it is. He said that the development of advanced computing, artificial intelligence, biotechnology, nanotechnology was proceeding so rapidly that it was on a logarithmic acceleration curve and a merger trajectory into a new class of self-replicating synthetic organisms that cast a huge shadow over the well-being and future and even survival of the human race and other natural biological beings on this planet in the 21st century. But, says Joy, what we need to say is that there is such a thing as renunciation. And what he meant by that was not that we go into a medieval monastery, but rather that everything that we as a human community and a human intellectual civilization are capable of thinking, inventing, and doing, we don't necessarily have to do because we can do it. Doesn't mean that we should do it. And it doesn't mean that we necessarily will. The technology is not neutral, and that we have to make choices about boundaries and limits and balances. Chagrov, who is an early geneticist, laid the foundation for Watson and Crick's development of the DNA. He said the same thing. There are some roads that we should not go down. We should set a boundary. And of course, there are precedents for this. They're imperfect, they're fragmented, but there are. You know, we did, some people might disagree, but most people I think agree. You know, we have bald eagles where I live. We have brown pelicans. We have peregrine falcons because DDT was banned. There is a international chemical weapons ban. Yes, chemical weapons are sometimes used. But I don't think it is a surprise that I say they would be far more widespread if we did not have that International Chemical and Biological Weapons Convention. So there are places where people have set boundaries, set limits. There is now a move from we need to put scrubbers on the stacks and we need to drive more efficient cars to, you know what, we need to end the fossil fuel era. We need to leave it in the ground and we need to make our stand there. Like they said at Standing Rock, we're not protesters, we're protectors. We are standing in the way of those forces of the fossil fuel industry that are destroying Mother Earth, the water, and that which gives life to the people of the planet. So there is that ability to say no, to set a boundary, to set a balance, to recognize that not all inventions and not all devices are neutral. And I think that that is a very, very important principle that Bill Joy shared with us. You should check out his essay, Why the Future Doesn't Need Us. It's pretty sobering, but it does end on that hopeful note. We ended our conference in Hood River, Oregon on a similar note in 2010 with a song from the British folk band Seize the Day. Okay, and they talk about the history of one of the largest workers' movements in European, the annals of European civilization. We tend to use this word Luddite as a sort of an epithet, and we tend to think of the Luddites as this sort of extreme, narrow little faction. But in fact, this was not the case. In 1811 and 1812 and 1813, this was the largest workers' movement in Europe. There were thousands and thousands and thousands of people involved in this, in direct action, in resistance, in plowshares actions, right, at these semi-automated early factories that were displacing people. As they say in the song about breaking the machines, for if and we don't break them, our lives, they will take them. Our craft, our cottage, our village as well, no freedom, nor laughter. For those who come after, but a slave and a master in a factory hell. So the Luddites rose up in mass numbers in England, and he took the British Empire, the most powerful empire in the history of the world to that point. More troops to put down the Luddite uprising than they were using against their main rivals, the French, across the channel. Okay. So what Seize the Day is saying in the song, it's a beautiful lyrical song. And at the end of it, they say, you know, they bring it back to the present. And they say, now, some call it futility. They say the future will be what the engines of progress demand. But Lud called humanity back to reality. We weave our destiny with our own hands. Thank you. Let's open it up for discussion here. I want to hear, you know, Rotten Tomatoes, questions, comments, whatever. So let's open it.
Yes, feel free. Just go ahead and I don't think we need a microphone. Just speak out.
We can hear each other. So I know I didn't address probably all of the points that people raised. I tried to touch on some of them. But feel free to jump in. Let's have a bit more discussion here. Yes?
Okay, getting back to AI and ARPA and the profitability.
I'm sorry, what's that?
Getting back to the profit
motive, yeah.
Profitability and DARPA putting so much money into
it. Oh, yeah.
And DARPA. The whole idea that special ops and CIA just have unlimited budgets. And this is the kind of stuff that the money goes for. So we're subsidizing training people how to kill each other.
Right.
It happened for years. But the right. point is, this seems to be okay with most people. And I don't think if people fully took the time to study the issues that they would be as comfortable with it.
Well, part of it is I think that people are not necessarily that happy with it, but they feel very disempowered. They feel very stretched economically, and they are very, very distracted. What does Michael Franti say? Anybody know Michael Franti, the musician? He's an amazing guy, and in one of his songs we were listening to in the car, he says, all addicted to the same nicotine, all addicted to the same gasoline, all addicted to a Technicolor screen, right? So people are very, very, seduced by their devices, they're very distracted, they're stressed economically, and they feel disempowered. They feel that social movements can't change things. That was one of the things, I think, and I'm not here to pitch for Bernie Sanders, I'm not saying that, but I'm just saying that was an example of something that gave people and people across generations hope and energy, like there could be a change, right? And I think that not just in the electoral realm, which has its significance, right? But I think also in the non-electoral realm. Standing Rock is another example, totally non-electoral, non-partisan. But that galvanized a significant sector of the nation. It gave people a sense of hope and empowerment and the veterans pouring out there. So I think that we need to look for ways that we can break people out of their distraction and also out of their sense of powerlessness. In 2004, Meg and I went into occupied Iraq twice. We went through Jordan, through Amman. First time mostly collecting testimonies, from people, Sunni, Shia, Christian, Iraqis. It's amazing how educated these people were. Always running into, doctors, lawyers, engineers, people who spoke Arabic, English, Spanish. Anyway, and collecting testimony, and we coming back with their stories to the United States. I think Meg and I did about 60 or 70 slideshows. The little things in the cardboard frames, carousel. Anyway, I still use them. But anyway, and we tried to take back the Iraqi narrative that we heard. Iraq was a classic example of how not every movement and people in the world fits into neat liberal and conservative categories. Don't, paradox. It doesn't fit our categories, like Muqtada Sadr's movement in the slums of Baghdad and Sadr City and Karbala and Najaf. So anyway, and we found that there was a different narrative than what people were hearing from the government and what they were hearing from the peace movement. There was a third version, which although a lot of Iraqis disagreed with each other, there was a kind of a consensus narrative from Iraq, which did not really fit into the government line. And it didn't exactly fit into the peace movement line either. So we tried to share that with people so that they would be aware of what we found. And the second time we went back, it was a very, very focused deal. In the spring of 2004, further into the occupation, much turmoil in Iraq, Shiite uprising in key cities. And when we came through Amman, Jordan, a lot of the people from the NGOs in Iraq were actually on their way out, including Christian Peacemaker teams, so because it was that bad. But, you know, we had determined to go in. Our friend Mario Galvan from California and Meg and myself and a number of other people, Catholic worker participant in our delegation, went in as the Najaf emergency peace team because we saw Najaf as the pivot point of potential world war with the Shiites, okay? It's the holy city of the Shiites, people come from all over the world. And it was surrounded on three sides by the U.S. military. And we said, you know, this is going to trigger a war with Iran. This is going to trigger a war with the whole Shiite world. This is a crazy thing for the U.S. military to try and take this over. We talked to soldiers. We talked to the commanders. We talked to people in the Iraqi government. We talked to people in the rebel movement. We talked to shopkeepers and street sweepers and bankers and all these people. And even the people who disagreed with each other, the Iraqis, we're really glad we were there because this is incredible, you know, that American civilians are trying to establish a presence and say to the U.S. military, if you invade Najaf, there will be at least a few American civilians who've chosen to put themselves there. And we were kind of shepherded in by this guy, Hussein Shahrastani, who was a physicist imprisoned by Saddam for 10 years because he, as a physicist, had refused to work on Saddam's nuclear bomb program. See, a lot of people we talked to, even Sunnis, hated Saddam. And they were glad the U.S. had kicked him out. That's why it didn't really fit with it. But they were very, very suspicious of what the U.S. government was doing. One guy said, the United States hired Saddam, paid Saddam, fired Saddam. The student is gone. Now the master is here.
You have been listening to Peter Lumstein, who is affiliated with Washington State Physicians for Social Responsibility, speaking at an event July 6, organized in part by PeaceWorks Kansas City. Some of the details of this talk are documented in the description of this episode of All Souls Forum at kkfi.org.